KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
When thinking about Peace Corps, it is amazing to remember that over the past 50 years, 200,000 people have served.
We not only need to prevent service cuts in our region, we have to ultimately be in a position to be able to grow that service in order to meet the mounting demands from the public.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local.
It is. Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic? It's just all across the board organic.
That was a clip from the clip from Portlandia, the TV show Portlandia, about how natural their chicken was. A little later in the program, we're going to be talking about the focus on all natural and how that has affected people's buying, but also how it affects us as environmentalists. We also heard from Carrie Hessler-Radelet on Peace Corps volunteers and how many Peace Corps volunteers come from Washington State. We'll talk about that. Maybe get some of your stories. Send it now. Weekday at KUOW.org. I'd like to read to her some of the stories of Peace Corps volunteers from our state. And you heard Kevin Desmond on King County's Metro Transit and the service they're trying to provide and trying to pay for. On Monday, Kevin Desmond of Metro and SDOT went before the Seattle City Council and talked about the ways they were coordinating their efforts at service and the ways they were coordinating their efforts to lobby the legislature to give them authority to raise taxes to pay for a transit or to get the state to pay for that. Metro is asking the state of Washington to fund transit agencies at levels that existed before the motor vehicle excise tax was eliminated as the primary transit funding source. They're joined by the Washington State Transit Association, which is asking for the state to provide 22% of transit dollars out of all statewide transportation funding. That is about what other states provide on average, according to Kevin Desmond. Currently, Washington State provides less than 1% to transit from transportation dollars, he says. King County is asking the legislature to again authorize a local option funding source to apply to transit. The county now has a $20 car tab fee, but that's expiring. Also, WashDOT provided $32 million out of the viaduct project in mitigation. While the viaduct and the streets are being torn up, Metro got the money to add buses and service, but only through 2014, according to Desmond. That's it. Back in 2009, they had hoped that they had an agreement with the state in place that would create the finances or the opportunity to tax us to raise the finances to mitigate the traffic problems through at least the end of the project, as it's projected to be in 2016. But that is not where it stands right now, and so people like Kevin Desmond are looking for ways to both coordinate their service with SDOT on the streets and to get more money from the state legislature.
So we've got that gap, and that gap is about $17 million. Unless that gap is filled, we're going to have to, in effect, cut all of that mitigation service in June of 2014, which will, in my view, and I think many Peter Hahn, the SDOT director yesterday, certainly in agreement, is going to cause very significant transportation capacity problems if that service is removed when the contract expires. And as I pointed out in my presentation, that the concept of the mitigation has worked. There's about a 23% reduction in vehicular traffic on the viaduct right now. That's 25,000 fewer vehicle trips on the viaduct, and correspondingly, we've seen about a 17,000 daily transit trip increase during this period. So the exact theory of the mitigation program has played out, in fact.
But you need the legislature to do something it has yet to do, which is to give you the permanent taxing authority.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, the $32 million was financed out of the project itself, out of the viaduct project itself. And one can argue that since the project is causing the traffic problem, the project should finance the mitigation. So that is an angle for just finding money directly out of State Department of Transportation's budget to continue to do what we believe is their responsibility to do, at least through 2016. Then from 2016 through 2019 or so, the city is engaging in a whole series of also very disruptive projects on the waterfront, the seawall replacement, the demolition of the viaduct, and the rebuilding of Alaskan Way itself. And that is going to be causing very, very similar problems for our transit service. In some cases, maybe worse, depending on how they sequence the work. So we've got then beyond that about 3 years of very impactful construction, and we need to partner with the city to figure out how that will be mitigated. And then thirdly, tolling starts on the tunnel in 2016. That's expected to create some level, if not significant level, of automobile diversion onto local streets. How are we going to handle that as well? And that's something that the state of Washington has yet to grapple with. There's a Citizens Advisory Committee on tolling that issued its first report at the end of the year and will be issuing its recommendations to the state on the tolling level and how to mitigate the diversion impacts. That report should be in the summer.
Kevin Desmond is Metro General Manager. Did that advisory committee have good ideas for mitigation of the diversion?
No, they are leaving that to their next round. What they've identified, working with the experts at State DOT, roughly three different tolling levels. So at each tolling level, it raises a certain amount of revenue, but it correspondingly, the higher the toll, the more diversion. So they've identified that there are these diversion problems. And I think their next round of work is to begin to grapple with not only what the toll should be, but then depending on what they recommend on what the toll should be, how that will be mitigated. In fact, the presentation I gave to City Council yesterday is very much the same presentation I gave to that committee about 3 months ago.
You know, you mentioned that these projects City of Seattle will be undertaking will be disruptive to Metro. Are you requesting that the city pay for some of the disruption that will come to Metro service?
I would rephrase what you said. Not disruptive to Metro. They're disruptive to traffic and transportation in the city, and that's why the title of my presentation, that was joined by the City Department of Transportation's director, is "Keeping Seattle Moving." It's about how to maximize the capacity of the road network in Seattle, and that needs to be a multimodal solution. So the extent to which that there is highly disruptive construction that's constraining the ability to move people and goods and services on the roads, we need to find a way to mitigate the impacts so that we can find the most effective way to keep the city moving. That requires, in our view, continued effective transit service on that corridor. And in order to get that effective transit service and the kind of capacity which we've now proven through the first round of the mitigation project, keep that amount of capacity to retain and attract more riders, we need resources to do that.
Well, does Peter Hahn and the City of Seattle agree that they're the place to search for some of those resources?
I think we're having those discussions, and yesterday's discussion at the City Council was a good first step to begin to realize what we're up against with the various different projects through the end of this decade. So I think it ultimately needs to be a partnership in some form between the state, the city, and the county.
What are the streets in Seattle, given this construction you're talking about, but also just more generally, that are most worrisome to you as a bus transit operator? I'm talking about traffic lights, I'm talking about lanes, and I'm talking about bicycle plans.
Well, the first thing that's important to us is particularly coming from the south. So that's pretty much all the service that comes over the West Seattle Bridge and that eventually transitions currently to 99. We need to find a permanent pathway once all this construction is done. And in the meantime, we need to find a temporary pathway. The permanent pathway is likely going to be going from the West Seattle Bridge to Highway 99, and then we have to get off at about Dearborn. And then the more likely pathway is how do we get as reliably as possible from Dearborn on local streets to Columbia, which would then become the Midtown portal for all of that service. Right now, the street design would show that we have to go through something like 8 to 12 traffic signals. And there'll be a lot of traffic on those local streets. How do we prioritize? So we've asked the city for all-day HOV lanes, in effect, for transit in both directions. That is, by the way, the same corridor where our Rapid Ride C line will be operating. So SDOT is struggling, certainly, with a lot of competing priorities. They've got very limited pavement space for buses, for cars, for freight, for Coleman Dock, for Washington State Ferries, for bikers, you know, in their vision of whether there's a cycle track or a bike lane, however ultimately they design Alaskan Way. In the meantime, during all of this construction between now and 2019, when all of this very disruptive construction is going to take place, where are the buses going to go? And that is a question that, you know, neither SDOT or certainly not Metro, we don't have the answer. In fact, we have to really rely on SDOT to figure out how they want to sequence all the construction work. So they're looking at a variety of different corridors where the buses would go, and there's many different options at this point. The point being that the corridor, which is now now Highway 99, is going to have to shift off of 99 for a period of time, and we and SDOT need to figure out where to put those buses, how much it's going to cost us to operate on those streets if they're slower than they are now, and what transit priority measures the city is going to be able to put in place to help minimize some of the impact of the construction and ultimately provide our customers with an attractive alternative to driving. That's what this is about, is can we create an attractive enough alternative to driving that you take some of the pressure off the streets because you've provided enough transit capacity to find a different balance of how the street network works to keep Seattle moving.
That's Kevin Desmond. He is the general manager of King County Metro Transit. Unlike last year, the suburban cities and the transit agencies statewide seem to be on the same track in asking for more taxing authority or more money from the state. According to both Desmond and Peter Hahn, the director of the Seattle Department of Transportation, the two agencies are also trying very hard to work together, coordinating these projects we were talking about to ease congestion in the city as the work on the viaduct, the Mercer Mass continue, and the newer bus rapid transit lines operate on city streets.
The only way BRT can successfully operate is if it can keep its speed and reliability through the system. And therefore, it needs to have the right kinds of street configuration, the right kind of signal prioritization, and basically you make a determination that transit comes first. And so it could be exclusive bus lanes, like, for example, on Avalon, the part of Avalon just before the buses get onto the bridge, and during peak hours there would be no parking, so the buses can have prioritization on making that turn. It could be signals. It can be moving the bus stops out, so the curb out, so that buses don't have to move to the right, pull into the station, and then try to get back into traffic, and they have to wait for cars. They just stay in line. All of those are examples of where bus prioritization needs to be made very clear. It could also be, as buses are coming down Columbia and getting onto the viaduct, how do they get to, from the curb lane onto the lane that lines up with the viaduct entrance on Columbia. So there are multiple examples of where the streets have to be made available in such a way that Metro can continue having reliability. The future example that's of great concern that Kevin Desmond and Metro and Executive Constantine have made very clear is that when they lose that key Seneca ramp on the northbound 99 direction, they are concerned about how their south pathways will efficiently enter the city through Columbia, two-way Columbia. And they want to make sure that as we designed the new Alaskan Way Alaskan Way Street, that transit is first and foremost. And we're working together to figure out how that needs to work so that transit remains viable. Because ultimately, if we want to make transit the backbone of our mitigation for all the projects and all the growth that we're going to have in the city, transit has to be made attractive for people to take.
Peter Hahn is director of SDOT. You know, it sounds like you folks are all working together, but haven't you had conflicts about trying to get the rapid ride up and running, and Metro needs clear paths in some of these rapid rides on Aurora and other places, and you've been unable to give them the kind of lanes they need? That's one example. Haven't you had complaints about that?
when construction occurs, then everybody can be impacted by the construction. Some of the problems that the latest round of BRT implementation, the West Seattle line, the Battle line, had to do with completion of the physical aspects, the shelters and the lanes. And interestingly, some of that work was done by the City of Seattle for Metro. Other part of the work was done by private sector contractors working for Metro. The parts that were late were not the City of Seattle parts. It was the other part of the work, which didn't quite come together by the September 29th transition date on the service. So I think we work extremely well together. Kevin and I we're together so often. We're practically in the same agency, and we continue to work together. It doesn't mean that every aspect is perfect all the time, but you know, they come up with ideas, we meet on them, we implement them, and that's our pledge to each other and to the people of this region. That we have to. We don't have a choice. We have to work completely together.
You know, you have this open house that the city is having in order to talk about linking the streetcar from First Hill and the one that runs
Yes, tonight at 5:30. Please come, you all. 5:30 tonight at Bertha Landis City Hall.
You're going to have, you have about $900,000 to spend on a study of those, that idea? Where would the money at this point, where's the thinking that we'd have the money to link and pay for these new streetcars?
So typically, when we build a streetcar, there are a couple of sources. One is that there are programs that the federal government runs that allow to pay for starts of systems of this size. And then typically, you also need a local source, which could be either it could be like it was in South Lake Union. It had been a what's called a local improvement district, abbreviated LID, and then other sources, and of course fares. And here's the thing to remember is that Sound Transit Board recently accelerated its planning for projects, and as you may know, that Sound Transit is based on a sub-regional equity basis of money within a certain sub-area gets to be spent in that sub-area. So if Sound Transit decides to go to another vote, the City of Seattle has to be able to identify the kinds of projects it'll want to have in that kind of a vote. And we can't just be sitting and kind of say, oh, we're not sure or we don't know. So there are connections that we want to make that were identified in the transit master plan. And as you well know, in the Sound Transit votes, the City of Seattle is always disproportionately a high level of approval, and our vote is needed to make the system grow, whether it's growing up toward Everett, whether it's growing down toward Tacoma, or more on the east side from Bellevue on to Redmond. So, but if we don't have projects that our citizens can understand and that they feel compelled to support, then we're not going to be as successful in a regional vote. So as I said, the Sound Transit Board in the last 2 or 3 months unanimously expressed the need to accelerate its high-capacity planning for the project, and we're just doing our part of it as well, and defining good projects for the city.
So that's Peter Hahn, Director of Seattle Department of Transportation. We heard from Kevin Desmond, General Manager of King County Metro Transit, talking about how they're working together and also how they're trying to mitigate for some of the congestion that's taking place because of all the projects in the city. Over on Facebook, weekday on KUOW, I ask you how you think they're doing and where they could do better around this region. And later next week, we'll talk to some of the folks who are also analyzing what's happening in transportation, how they think the agencies are doing, and what needs to be done. This is Weekday.
Living an all-natural lifestyle sounds like a great idea, and a lot of people are going that way. but it can be a lot of extra work. You're reading labels, paying more for some stuff. Is it worth the extra effort? We'll take that up in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine, delivering primary and specialty care to patients at Harborview Medical Center, UW Medical Center, Northwest Hospital, Valley Medical Center, 9 UW Neighborhood Clinics, and Airlift Northwest. More information at uwmedicine.org.
Cloudy over Seattle, it's 46 degrees. Forecast says breezy and cloudy today with showers and a high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:25. A conversation with the director of the Peace Corps in 20 minutes.
Now we're going to take a look at the question of living an all-natural world. Organic, all-natural products are on the rise. Grocery chains around the country have expanded their options in free-range, non-toxic, and organic. Maybe people are trying to make healthier choices for their bodies and their worlds, but is it always the best approach? And what about some of the problems people encounter, the questions they have? Are those the questions that we should be asking? Nathaniel Johnson is a journalist. He writes for Harper's, New York, Outside, San Francisco magazines. He's also produced stories for This American Life. He has a new book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier.
Hold
and
your breath.
And if you can have a longer subtitle to a book.
I was impressed that you got that all out.
I appreciate you being here.
I sure am glad to be here.
So I want to, you don't know this issue, but I want to posit it to you by way of your argument. I got an email from a fellow who works for a free market think tank, Todd Myers. He's their environmental person there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written some books about a book about the way environmentalists maybe have taken environmental issues to the extreme and sometimes get unintended consequences. And the House Environment Committee is going to, in Washington State, is going to consider a ban on flame retardant compounds.
Yeah.
It would ban a compound called TRIS and also give DOA the authority to ban future flame retardant compounds unless the manufacturer demonstrates that it's not – there's no technically feasible, safer alternative. Now, this all started because they banned PBDE a few years ago, which was a flame retardant compound that was right. showing up in the food chain.
Yeah.
And now they're finding that TRIS, the replacement, may be worse.
Right.
So there's your – you know, there's your sort of your conundrum.
Exactly.
The way you've set it up in the book.
Yeah.
And I wonder, knowing what I've just explained to you and no more, how would you approach something like this?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think that free marketeers are often guilty themselves of taking the ideology too far as well. But I think that this is absolutely true, that the environmental movement and I consider myself a part of that, has taken this ideology and made it very black and white in some cases. And really, it's this all-out fight of good against evil. And sometimes the evils that you're fighting are replaced by even greater evils. Now, the question is, what do we do now? It's interesting when you – I didn't write about this, but when you look at the flame retardants, there's the Chicago Tribune just had a – amazing series on this, looking at how the tobacco industry was really behind the push to get the flame retardants in because everything was burning down when people were going to sleep with their cigarettes, and now that people aren't smoking so much, there really isn't the same need for to just saturate all our furniture with flame retardants.
Well, that is interesting. So again, we have to look for original. First causes, original reasons.
Exactly.
That's interesting. You talk about ecological anxiety a lot in your book. What is that?
Well, I think ecological anxiety is what everybody who listens to public radio feels. if you're listening to this, you probably have it. It's the feeling of being overwhelmed, I think, that there's big problems out there, and it's hard for an individual to take them on, and things are really out of our control. You know, this food comes to you in the supermarket, and you're trying to figure out if it's going to kill you or if it's going to make you live longer, and you don't know who's touched it. You know, it comes from faraway people. And
man, that is anxiety if you're worried about who touched it.
Yeah, exactly. Who touched it and who made it? You know, what are the things that went into it? And we no longer have those those close connections where we can shake the hand of the person and like, all right, I trust you. You, whatever you put in this, I trust you.
Well, even though, I mean, is even that a good idea?
I think in some cases it is. You know, if the there's so I talk a lot about different ways of knowing in this book, telling these stories and getting into this. And one way of knowing is you know every single ingredient in your food, right? And you can look at that nutrition facts panel, and that'll tell you something. But as we delve into the science of nutrition, we're learning that we just know the tip of the iceberg. And I talk about this food chemist in UC Davis who's studying milk to get into this. And that nutrition facts panel may just be almost irrelevant, you know, based on what he's finding. So that older way of knowing where you tap into the tradition and you shake the hand of the person and you have sort of a gut feeling of who to trust, sometimes that's useful, I think.
What's a better way of knowing? Well, that's one.
That's one, yes. So I don't think that I think that this – I'm a big believer in science, and I think that we've got to use the science as best as possible. But the sum of our ignorance always overwhelms the sum of our knowledge in the end. There's some things that we are pretty certain about, but when it comes to, I'll just continue with nutrition. You know, the societies that have a good understanding of nutrition science are the same societies that are grappling with obesity and diabetes, and the societies that are quote unquote more primitive don't have these problems. And this seems to have something to do with the fact that we've taken the science that we have and assumed that that's all there is to know. And in fact, there's much, much more to know. And, you know, we've found one tiny little bit of it, but when you zoom out and look at the big picture, there are just these vast white spaces on the map that we have just begun to explore.
Give me an example of where, because we thought we knew something, we went awry.
So nutrition science is a really good one. Obviously, this because we the changes, the experiments that we've made in our national food system have ended up leading to this real problem.
Another, you talk about milk. One of the places you go is milk.
Right.
What are your examples from milk?
Well, I think that – so milk is a topic. Let me talk a little bit more about hygiene. And milk – I use the story of milk. I tell the story of the this outbreak that happened when all these kids were drinking raw milk and a lot of them got sick. But then there were all these funny things going on that some of the kids, you know, one kid drank just a glass of milk and his neighbor drank the rest of the carton. And the neighbor didn't get sick, but the kid that drank one glass got sick. And so people started scratching their heads. And as I dug into this, it looks like the real problem isn't just this one microbe that's causing the sickness. It's the entire ecosystem of the gut. And some of these kids have this very robust ecosystem, and we really evolved in this microbial soup, and we've done our best to distance ourselves from these microbial frenemies, I call them, with sanitation. We've raised this wall of sanitation between ourselves and the environment in which we came out of. And in many ways, that's been a good thing. We've eliminated all these diseases, but we've also been struck by this wave of autoimmune diseases, asthma, allergies, type 1 diabetes. These more serious autoimmune issues as well seem to be related to our separation from our microbial homeland.
Seem to be, though, right? We still don't have anything definitive.
We don't have anything definitive, but the it's considered a hypothesis at this point, but the evidence is so large. It's going to move from the scientific definition of hypothesis to to theory at any point. The evidence is it's among the scientific community that's studying this. People are pretty convinced.
Nathaniel Johnson has written All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. But hasn't there been in this natural approach a big slice of people who get down in the dirt and understand that or feel that they need to be exposing themselves to the world and yet try to eat natural, eat out of gardens, build themselves up that way? Isn't that been part and parcel of their philosophies in some ways, some people's?
I think absolutely. I think that's sort of this back to the land movement that my parents in some ways were part of.
You see where I'm going with my question.
All right, continue.
Well, so your parents, how were you raised, you and your brother?
So I came from a family. I was born at home in Berkeley, California, and then my family, that wasn't natural enough, so we moved up to the country. And, you know, a lot of brown rice at dinner, a lot of kale,
the new hip food.
Yes, actually, we were ahead of the times. And it was really a wonderful childhood in some ways, backpacking every summer, that sort of thing. And so I have a lot of sympathy for these ideas, these natural ideas. But I also got this front row seat in my family on all the ways in which things just went catastrophically wrong when you trusted in nature.
Like?
Well, okay, one funny example is my dad really believed that diapers were Satan's tool, you know, that they were just bad.
All diapers?
Yes. Cotton, organic cotton, natural diapers. The idea was that, and this comes from Ida Rolf, the masseuse, that having this wad of cloth between the baby's legs for like 3 years while the legs are growing faster than they ever will grow again can deform the legs, and you end up with these duck-footed kids walking around. And so, but you know, when you look at this, every single professional athlete probably had diapers on, you know, and they go to the Olympics and they're fine, you know. And my gait is actually, I have one foot that points off to the side despite, you know, having these diapers. And not having them. I can only imagine how much work it was for my parents. I have a daughter now and she wears diapers.
She does. It's a good thing that you lived in out in the country. They could just send you outside.
That's right.
You were like a cow.
Free range babies.
Free range babies. All right. They didn't believe in technology.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, but they, they didn't want to have a TV in the household. They believed that a TV would rot our brains, and they read Neil Postman's famous book, Entertaining Ourselves to Death, and they really took that to heart, that instead of TV, we needed to be singing together, and we needed to be reading books, and these were all really wonderful things, but at the same time, you know, eventually I got exposed to TV, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I saw MTV as a young teenager, and I was like, I want that. How do I get that life? You know, and I didn't realize that this was a copy of something that never really existed in the real world.
So just like with exposing yourself to get your gut fully fluorated.
Yeah.
I don't know if I just made that word up. full of flora. Better in the modern world to be exposed so you can understand?
You know, this is just my personal opinion, but I kind of think so.
Hence writing the book.
Yes. Writing a book makes opinion into expertise. It's a very strange thing. You know, that's not something that a lot of this I really went in and I delved into the science, and I feel like I have a good understanding. It's much fuzzier with television and computers. You know, will playing on the computer rot your kid's brain and turn them into an automaton, or will it turn them into Steve Jobs?
Well, all right. I will. But you are in this. You are in this dichotomy. You're trying to be in the gray area. But you did look at some specifics. So what about the childbirth movement?
Yeah.
You looked at the natural childbirth movement, of which you were a part. Mm-hmm. What are you learning about what happens in hospitals, what midwives offer?
Yeah. So childbirth was really interesting. I started doing my reporting on this, and within about 10 phone calls, you know, linking one expert, who else should I call? And I got to someone who said, well, you know, in California, the maternal mortality rate, women dying in childbirth, is actually going up at this point. And that just blew my mind. And they said, you know, we think that this is related in some way to the rise in cesarean section rate. And so there it looks like, although our obstetrical technology has saved millions of lives over the years, if you look back to the 1900s when women died in childbirth all the time, at this point, we may have gone too far. We may be doing something wrong. And there's a lot of indicators. Maternal mortality also is – maternal morbidity, severe injuries during birth has gone way up and, again, as associated with cesarean sections. So that was a real shocker for me, that there is this gray area, that this technology is really useful in some cases, but there is such a thing as too much.
What do you learn from spending time with midwives?
Well, I had an amazing trip out to Tennessee. I went and visited Ina Mae Gaskin at the farm, this commune in Tennessee. And Ina Mae is the head midwife out there. And they were on this caravan of buses coming out from San Francisco looking for a place to live. And the women started giving birth and they just started delivering them. And so they kind of formed this ad hoc form their own form of obstetrics, and they a doctor came and gave them instruction, and they studied the text. But they kind of got to they didn't have the technological lock in that we have. They kind of got to innovate on their own. And one thing I learned from her is that the feelings that a woman experiences are really important, and that's not something that we're not so good at dealing with feelings in Western medicine. Because the same feelings that make a woman feel secure and safe are really essential for a successful birth, opening the cervix. And there seems to be an evolutionary basis for this, where humans seek out help for these difficult births, whereas no other animal that I know of – I shouldn't say no other, but that I know of most other animals go off alone to give birth. And so she is talking about how she tells jokes, you know, during labor, and she spends more time getting to know what makes women tick, you know, what makes them laugh, what makes them cry, how their relationships are, than checking the vital signs. I mean, she spends a lot of time on that too. But
as somebody who's looking at the signs, can we say that their effort reduces maternal mortality or morbidity?
I think it's hard to say. They're a special case because, you know, they're sort of famous and they have women flying in from Egypt to give birth there. And so you have a slightly different population. But when you look at other cases, there are these midwifery centers in – like there's a good example of one in urban Washington, D.C. that serves a population of generally poor African-American women. And – they have amazing statistics for low birth weight babies, all of these things, much better than the surrounding statistics.
So Nate Johnson's written All Natural. Another thing you looked at were toxins and our concerns about toxins.
Yep.
Takes us back to PDBEs, plastics leaching into our food, containers that we put in microwaves. So you talked to a person, a toxicologist, Peter Spencer, at the Albert Einstein Medical College. What was
now
at
OHSU?
Oh, he's down at OHSU.
Yeah.
So, what was his research? What was he looking at in particular?
Well, he is interested in plant toxins, and he's tracked down all of these different toxins from different plants, starting with a toxin in a pea in the grass pea in India that causes this terrible paralysis called latharism. Hmm. And he was able to show that it was this chemical in the wonderful natural vegetable that was causing this. And so I talked to him about Guam because there's something really fascinating and strange about Guam because there are more incidences of Parkinson-like and ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. The incidence there is way higher than in other places. And so scientists are trying to figure out what is it? There must be some environmental thing that's causing this. And if we can figure this out, it'll tell us a lot about these horrible mystery diseases around the rest of the world. And so he thinks that it might be related to a type of vegetable called the cycad that the people eat and does have a lot of poisons in it. And he has all of these – he's published all of these papers showing how the accumulation of these poisons could act as a slow toxin over many years and then kick in.
So in the context of this book, what's your conclusion or your thoughts about what that tells us about the debate between all natural and not?
Well, it really made me relax a little bit about about chemicals and toxins in general, because we live in a world full of nasty poisons, and some of these plant poisons are engineered by plants to actually go after us. They're not just these random things that we create by accident that that's end up sabotaging our cellular machinery. They're actually made to attack predators. And so it made me feel a little bit more relaxed that we're pretty tough. We evolved in this environment where we had to fight off these poisons, and I worry a little less about every little pesticide that I take in, which I think is a healthy thing. It's healthy, mentally healthy, because if you worry about all of that stuff all the time, you end up becoming this anxiety person.
But you still apply science to as much as you can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I quote Wendell Berry in that chapter, and he says, you know, it's something like the question isn't how to act with certainty. The question is how to act gracefully on the basis of partial knowledge. And this is sort of the question of life in general.
Nathaniel Johnson's exploration of that is called All Natural. I appreciate you talking to us.
Oh, it's been so great to be here.
It's good. He'll also be at Town Hall tonight, 7:30, talking about these issues. Doors open at 6:30, and you can have coffee and baked goods and consider what they mean. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
It's a weekday.
Nine 47, Washington State students and the Peace Corps in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
The largest coal export terminal on the West Coast could be built near Bellingham. Find out what moving Wyoming coal through the Northwest could mean for your community. I'm Ashley Ahern, KUOW's environment reporter. Join me for a panel discussion at Seattle's Town Hall on February 13th. Details at earthfix.kuow.org. See you there.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
45 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Forecast says breezy today, clouds and showers with a high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:48. The post office says it's ending Saturday mail delivery. That's in the news at 10.
Now a little talk about the Peace Corps. The United States Peace Corps has released its rankings of top recruits from undergraduate schools. University of Washington has been number one in the category of big schools for 5 years in a row. This year, Western Washington University and Gonzaga University joined the list for top medium and small schools. So Washington State is big in Peace Corps recruitment. So that means you probably were part of the Peace Corps. So since we have the acting director of the U.S. Peace Corps here, how about sending us some stories of why you decided to join the Peace Corps? Carrie Hessler-Radelet is acting director of the U.S. Peace Corps. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
And our email, weekday@kuow.org, shoot us a short paragraph so I can give her some stories, because you're going to give me some stories.
Absolutely.
You were sworn in as deputy director in 2010.
That's right.
Why are you acting director today?
Our director, Aaron Williams, stepped down in September, and since that time I've been acting director. We're waiting for President Obama to nominate a new director.
Well, I thought maybe it was one of those things where, like many things in the administration, people are only acting because Congress hadn't yet acted.
Nope, not in this case.
Do you like your job?
I love my job. It's a real privilege to work at Peace Corps.
You were a volunteer yourself.
I was a volunteer in Samoa from 81 to 83. But more importantly, actually, is I come from a four-generation Peace Corps family, the only family that I know of that has had that distinction.
How did your parents pull that, and your grandparents or your children?
Actually, my aunt was the first volunteer in the early 60s. She served in Turkey, and she was actually the 10,000th volunteer.
Wow.
And then my grandparents did it after they retired. They went to Malaysia and served in a university there after my grandfather had had a long career with General Motors and my grandmother had been a high school guidance counselor.
Now, what did they do in Malaysia?
They were university professors at the University of Ipoh.
Why did that university need Peace Corps people? Why didn't they have their own people to hire?
Well, you know, back in the early 70s, Malaysia did not have a significant number of folks with PhDs, and now they do. Actually, Malaysia is a real success story, but at the time they needed a little help in terms of educating their next generation of chemical engineers and high school guidance counselors. So my grandparents were really happy to meet that call.
Isn't it interesting how specific it was?
Yeah,
that they were needed.
Exactly.
Some very specific issues.
Exactly.
What did you do? What was
my
your
husband
job?
And I went. I served with my husband, Steve Radlett, and we were teachers at a secondary school, an all-girls Catholic school in Western Samoa, and it was a wonderful experience.
What were you teaching? Everything?
I taught English, history, geography, social studies, PE, and music. And Steve taught just about everything else.
Now, again, why did Western Samoa need a Peace Corps?
At the time, they didn't have a sufficient number of secondary school teachers, people who had received college degrees and were proficient in English, because they were following a curriculum from New Zealand, which I believe they still follow. And they didn't have enough teachers who were qualified to teach university entrance and school certificate, so the higher levels in the secondary schools.
So
we continue to serve in Western Samoa in that capacity.
In that capacity.
Yeah, and although teacher training.
Now
we've moved really to a focus on teacher training.
So the goal is, what is the goal?
The goal is to help the countries where we work to meet their own development goals. And also, we are building bonds of friendship between our countries. We have two goals. Actually, we have three goals. But the first is a development goal. The second is to promote a better understanding of Americans on the part of people served. And then the third goal is to bring the world back home by promoting a better understanding of other countries on the part of Americans. So the development goal first, and then the second and third goals are cross-cultural.
Those second two goals, important, admirable. The first goal, you've heard people criticize aid groups in general for not allowing for local economies, local systems to emerge. Right. What's your response to that in terms of the Peace Corps?
Well, for Peace Corps, we have an entirely different model. Our model is integration. So we go into a community without our own agenda, although we work in six sectors, which are agriculture, environment, health, education, community economic development, and youth development. So we send volunteers who are trained in those sectors, and they're trained with evidence-based best practices so that they can work to improve the development of those communities in which they serve. But we go only at the invitation of the host country, and we go into communities to help them achieve their development goals. Nowadays, even villages have development plans, and we're there to help them meet their own needs.
I like that idea.
Yeah, and our model is different in that our volunteers live in the same kind of housing. They often live with a host family, in fact. They speak the language. They eat the same food. They ride the same broken-down bus. They live like a member of the community. They're not like a foreign consultant who drives around in a big white SUV and stays in a hotel.
Yeah. Well, tell me how you really feel about it.
Actually, I did that world for 25 years, and I actually love that world, too.
Is that right?
I actually think that there are some real benefits from foreign aid. Yeah, I had a 25-year career in public health.
In between,
yeah. And in fact, my Peace Corps service prepared me for that. And if you want me to tell that story, I will. But you know, I think there's a lot of good work that comes out of foreign aid, but I think it has to be done right, and it really has to be focused on building capacity.
Well, give me the reason it transformed you. Your Peace Corps work brought you to the public health issues.
Okay. Well, I was a teacher, and I loved being a teacher. But one thing that Peace Corps does is, I said earlier, we assign host families to each of our volunteers, and my host family was Losa and Viane. I was 24 when I went into Peace Corps, and Losa was 31. She had 8 children already. And when I, about 6 months after I arrived there, I came home after school, and she was just sobbing inconsolably. I mean, she could hardly breathe. And it turns out the reason for her despair was that she was pregnant again. And she had had all of her babies delivered on the floor of her house, unattended by a health provider. Her sister-in-law had attended the birth. And Losa was just exhausted and could not imagine how she could bear another pregnancy and how she was going to feed another mouth. There was a health facility that was less than a mile away. She had never been there for her own health care, although she had taken her children there for immunizations. And so I knew nothing about pregnancy, but I knew that she needed to see a trained provider. So we went together to the health facility, her first ever visit, prenatal visit, after 8 children. And the midwife took one look at her and said, you need to have your baby here in this facility. You're severely anemic, so you need iron tablets, and you need to come and see me every week. We went back to her house. Her husband was adamant that her baby would be born at home, like all other Samoan babies. And it took 4 months of active engagement between the midwife and myself and Losa to convince Viane that she should be allowed to have her baby in the facility. And on the day when the baby was born, you know, the baby was born quickly. It was her 9th child, after all. But shortly thereafter, she went into postpartum hemorrhage. And she would have absolutely died if she had had that baby on the floor of her house, as she had every single other one. And so I like to say that my career in public health was born that day as well, because I really saw how any health planner would look at the map and say, this woman has excellent access. She was less than a mile from the health facility. It was a good road, but there were so many cultural boundaries that kept her from accessing the care that she needed. And so I really have devoted my life to trying to figure out ways of using local culture to improve access.
That's the best argument for the Peace Corps you could give, right?
Absolutely. And there are literally thousands and thousands of stories like that.
200, right?
210,000 returned volunteers.
Carrie Hessler-Radelet is acting director of the U.S. Peace Corps. So 12,000 people apply every year. 4,000 are accepted. You got 8,000 volunteers right now in 76 host countries. And you have mid-career professionals getting a chance to serve for shorter periods.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
Peace Corps response.
Because I, you know.
Yeah, you absolutely. We'd love to have you. You'd be fantastic.
I don't have agriculture or.
It's okay. We can use you. We can train you. Believe me. We have two programs. First of all, our regular 2-year program, we have many people over 50 who decide they want a second career, people who have always wanted to go into the Peace Corps. So that's our primary program. Then we have a new program called Peace Corps Response, which is a shorter term, higher impact program, which complements our regular 2-year program. So people go in for a period of 3 months to a year, and they're for very targeted kinds of assistance. You know, frankly, if we had had this program when my grandparents were around, they would have gone in through Peace Corps Response, because the specific kind of post that they had would have been probably more conducive to a Peace Corps Response program. But anyway, we have programs in our 6 sectors, and we welcome both non-return Peace Corps volunteers, so people who have never yet served as Peace Corps volunteer, and then we also have a significant number of return volunteers who re-up.
Very cool. Why do you think that Gonzaga, Western Washington, and the UW have so many Peace Corps volunteers?
Well, you know, we've been talking about this. What is it about Washington that gives us such a great concentration of Peace Corps applicants? And it's not only just in the university category or age category. We also have a high number of second career types, older volunteers. So there's something special about Washington. And I think it's because you are international, you're on our coast, you're very close to Canada, you have a huge concentration of really forward-thinking universities and corporations and foundations and nonprofit organizations that are engaged actively with the rest of the world. You have a passion for the environment. You know, people are into healthy living. You care about your community. You know, you're committed to service in general. People volunteer at a higher rate here than they do in some other parts of the country. And so all of I would say it seems to me that the values of people who live in your state really align with those of Peace Corps.
All right. And now we as mid-career people, we can go.
You can.
Carrie Hessler-Radelet is acting director of the U.S. Peace Corps. And as it was announced, Washington State, University of Washington, Western Washington University, and Gonzaga are top of the list for volunteers in the Peace Corps. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You know, may I say something? I would just like to say that Weekday, put together in large part by Amin Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst, and Katie Sewell, especially this hour of the program. But stick around for the next hour.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper tweeted photos this week of his pet cat and chinchilla. That and more news from Canada just a few minutes away. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Kieran Betty was the first woman to join.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.